Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Criminal Intentions, Season 1, Episode 2, Junk Shop Blues, by Cole McCade, narrated by Kurt Bonham. 0. Motive for Murder.
Marion Garvey has a long and storied history of people trying to kill him. It's a hazard of the business. A hazard of success, too. Scum always want to go for the heavy hitters at the top, the big dogs. And he's proud of being the kind of big dog who doesn't have to be afraid of showing underbelly, because even his underbelly is armored and bulletproof. He is untouchable. When Marion Garvey looks at himself, he sees the definition of a self-made man. The phrase, too big to fail, was made for him. When you're on top of the world, it's inevitable the small fry will try to take you down. Tonight, though, he's hardly expecting an attempt on his life. Tonight is special. He's been waiting for tonight for weeks, and after he went to the trouble of booking a honeymoon suite at the Wellington, everything had better damned well go off smoothly. He's thrown enough money at the valets, the bellboys, the fucking maids to make sure he'll get the VIP experience. He wants nothing but the best, and he damn well intends to give nothing but the best tonight. The jewelry box in his pocket weighs heavy. That weight is a sense of satisfaction, of pride, of promise, of wealth. He can buy the things other men only dream of. Whoever said money didn't buy happiness was just trying to make the best out of his sad lot in life. Money can buy anything, including happiness on demand. But his happiness comes from a more immediate source. As he hears the door slip open, the faint beep of a key card unlatching echoing from outside. He takes one last look around, taking in the champagne cooling in the ice bucket in perfect reach between the catering cart and the bed. Wherever this might happen to take them, the roses spread in splendor all across one wall. Over 300 fine red blooms without a single blemish, every last one hand-chosen and spilling their lush fragrance to fill the room. The petals of hundreds of more roses still turning the floor into a sea of blood. He's bought happiness, all right. He's bought it, and he won't let it go. Marion turns, a smile on his lips, and smooths his hands over his perfectly tailored suit, handmade to his specifications. Only the best, always. Only the best. "Darling," he says, and spreads his hands, only to stop as a strange wet feeling spreads in the center of his chest, dull and heavy. He looks down. His chest is red, he thinks numbly. What an odd shade of red, thick and somehow more vivid than other reds. The smell of the roses is so strong he can hardly pick out another smell, hot and thick and strangely metallic. Blood. Oh, that is his blood. He should feel pain, he thinks. He should feel pain, but there is only a sort of heavy numbness. His body doesn't want to move. His head is a balloon detaching from his body, taking his consciousness with it until he is separate from the shell of meat and blood and bone that had formed a man for over 37 years. 37 years in which he'd made himself into everything he'd wanted to be, only to be unmade in a single stroke. The handle protruding from his chest is black. The metal inside his flesh is cold. That he can feel. Every inch of the blade lying against his insides. This flat, cool sheet of stainless steel icing his flesh. Still no pain. That is a kindness, he thinks. That is a kindness money can't buy. He stares at the face wavering in his vision. At the resolute stare. At skin spattered in blood, his blood. Blood that had been cut out of his chest in splatters and still soaks warm down the front of his shirt. Why? He tries to ask. but when his head is floating and only tethered by the thinnest thread, his lips don't want to move. He's going to die on a bed of roses. He falls, and the last thing he hears is the rustle of leaves. The last thing he feels is the bite of thorns, hooking through his suit to find skin. The last thing he sees is the shower of petals, as rich and velvety red as his blood. He is cold, so cold, and still those familiar eyes stare through him, watching his life ebb away. 1. When the levee breaks. Song Jae-yoon sat stiffly in the plush leather chair of the departmental counselor's office and stared fixedly straight ahead. The counselor stared right back. They'd been like this for the last half hour, staring off across a room paneled in pleasantly honey-toned wood, festooned with so many plants that the light through the windows filtered green through their leaves. During the first 10 minutes, the counselor had asked him questions such as, "How do you feel?" and "Do you want to talk about what happened?" and "Have you been sleeping well at night?" "I feel fine," Song Jae had answered. "I do not want to talk about it. My sleep patterns are normal." The answers had been honest enough. The counselor had not seemed particularly pleased with them nonetheless, and so she had asked again and again, until Song Jae had stopped answering. Repeating himself was a waste of breath, a waste of time. Dr. Ryusaki seemed to feel the same, for the dark-eyed, plump little sparrow of a woman had only pursed her lips, crossed her legs, and rested her pad on her knee, tapping her pen against the paper thoughtfully and regarding him as if he were either some alien species or a particularly stubborn child she was determined to wait out. Finally, she sighed, shoulders slumping slightly, sagging inside her cashmere blouse. "Detective Yoon, I can't force you to talk to me, but many of the BPD officers have found it beneficial. I know you're new to our division, but you stepped into a particularly gruesome case, one that involved seeing gay and bisexual young men murdered in heinous ways. Considering that you asked to be on the case because you yourself are gay, it's not unreasonable to think the case would have had a psychological and emotional effect on you, regardless of the extent of your experience." Her gaze searched him, as if she was searching for a crack inside him, anywhere she could pry in deep. "I'm not going to pull you off duty if you admit a moment of vulnerability."
"Then what is the point of this? Are you not attempting to determine if I am fit for active duty?"
"It's required after such a shocking case. I need to at least see you. I haven't seen anything that would mandate sidelining you from active duty."
Ryusaki drummed her pen back and forth between her fingers.
"That doesn't mean I'm not concerned about you as a person."
"I told you. I am fine."
"Are you?"
Song Jae sighed.
"Do you think if you ask in a different way, I will answer differently?"
She half smiled, rather sadly.
"The thought might have crossed my mind."
She shook her head.
"Your job has a way of eroding at your humanity. Honestly, I worry more when people are fine than I do when they aren't. If you're indifferent to the idea of..."
"I did not say I was indifferent," Song Jae cut in. "I said I am fine."
"Ah."
She exhaled heavily, tapping her pen against her lower lip, before tucking it into the glossy slick of her black hair, pulled back into a neat chignon and just beginning to show signs of silver streaks throughout.
"If you have your own coping methods, that's less worrisome. But I'll still check on you in a week. For now, our time's up. Battle station's down, Detective Yoon."
She offered him a smile. He did not answer it. He only stood, shrugged into his coat, and headed for the door. But as his hand fell to the doorknob, she called after him.
"Detective Yoon?"
He stopped, glancing over his shoulder. She grinned wryly.
Tell your partner he's got 3 more days to avoid me or I'm benching him for real this time.
Songjae considered, then nodded.
As you say, he said, then twisted the doorknob and escaped Dr. Ryusaki's den. Malcolm Kalaji sat at his desk, restlessly flicking a pencil between his fingers. He didn't want to be here, sprawled back in his chair and staring blankly at his computer screen. He had places to be, a new case to investigate, and a partner to wait for, keeping him tethered on a leash when, if not for Songjae, Malcolm would have been out the door half an hour ago. He hated waiting. He hated waiting for someone else even more. The homicide bullpen was almost empty at this time of morning. They'd already been through the morning briefing. Everyone scattered to follow their own leads. Only a few people left behind doing desk work. And Sade, their voice drifting merrily from their spider's lair of cables, singing in a language Malcolm couldn't pick up. It was a different one every time. And he was really starting to wonder just how many Sade knew, and why. Not that he'd ever get an answer out of the cheerful little monster. The door to the hall swung open. Songjae cut into the room like a knife, all sharp edges covered neck to toe in black, his black button-down half untucked from his jeans, sleeves cuffed amid forearm against golden skin. A pair of unused vinyl gloves sprouted from the front pocket of his jeans, dangling against the denim. The day after they'd closed the park case, he'd shown up with a shopping bag full of several boxes of sterile vinyl surgical gloves. Without a word, he'd unceremoniously dumped them in a drawer of Malcolm's desk, then ripped one box open and filled his pockets with several pairs. Malcolm had tactfully chosen not to say a word. If he did, Songjae might switch back to latex out of spite. And Malcolm didn't need a full-on case of hives just because their hands brushed in passing.
Hands? Or anything else?
Not that he was thinking about that kiss. That kiss had meant nothing, felt like nothing. Nothing at all. Songjae threaded through the clusters of desks to Malcolm's. Angled black eyes locked on him unerringly, his red bruise of a mouth set in a thin, irritated line, the tousled mess of black hair shadowing his gaze.
"I take it didn't go well, then,"
Malcolm said as Songjae drew within earshot. Songjae worked his jaw, stopping next to Malcolm's desk with militant precision, hands tucking into the pockets of his jeans.
"It went." What did she say?
That you have 3 days or you are suspended. Malcolm groaned, dragging his hand over his face, thunking his head against the back of his chair.
I'll go when I'm ready.
Are you?
No,
he sighed.
But I was asking what she said about you.
She said nothing about me. Malcolm eyed Songjae.
Ryusaki will suspend you. Don't find out the hard way like I did.
Why would she suspend me when I attended my mandated counseling session?
Because you're a stubborn asshole who won't bend enough to admit that maybe, just maybe, that last case was too much for us. Too much for anyone.
But Malcolm was learning the art of grit-toothed silences with Songjae. And he ground his teeth together for a moment, giving himself that indulgence, that second to be irritated before he sighed and levered out of his chair, catching up his suit coat and draping it over his arm.
We have a case, downtown. Forensics beat us there.
He strode for the door. Songjae followed, the gliding raven at his shoulder, always there like some prophet of doom.
You seem agitated, Songjae said mildly.
Your appointment was long.
And your paperwork backlog is quite extensive.
Malcolm pinched the bridge of his nose.
Stop that.
Stop what?
With an annoyed sound, Malcolm stopped just past the door, turning in the hallway to glower at Songjae. Calm, implacable Songjae.
standing tall and unflappable in the doorway, his head cocked in that curiously inquisitive tilt that could mean, "I have no idea what you mean," or, "I do not understand why you are so emotional, human, but I find the phenomenon quite fascinating."
"I know," Malcolm growled. "I turn my shit into you now. I know. You don't have to grind the rank thing in."
I was not aware I was doing any such thing.
"Sure you weren't."
Songjay's expression didn't change, but something snapped in his eyes, unreadable and dark.
"As far as I am concerned, you and I are equals."
"Are we?"
Malcolm bit off, then reined himself in. He didn't know what was wrong with him today, why he was so irritable. Everything grated on his nerves, particularly Songjay. That implacable, icy calm and aloof elegance were getting under his skin more and more every day. It had been tolerable, though, while they were just working through old backlog on cold cases, identifying those that still had potential and familiarizing Songjay with what was on their docket for the last 6 months. Tedious work that bordered on clerical. Something Malcolm could deal with, even with Songjay always perched on the corner of his desk, like a black-feathered vulture, leaning over him and bringing in that hot scent of diesel and smoky musk and maleness until Malcolm's space was starting to smell more like Songjay than like Malcolm himself. But, of course, he'd picked the day when a new case had landed on their desk to reach breakpoint, until just the sight of Songjay's coolly unruffled stare was enough to push Malcolm to snarling. There was an easy fix for that, and Malcolm turned away, giving Songjay his back and heading for the stairs. The stairwell door banged open, echoing. Malcolm clattered down, Songjay silent in his wake, but still there.
"Would you like to educate me on the case we are pursuing?"
"I'll brief you in the car," Malcolm muttered. "When we get back, put in a requisition for your own desk. If you had your own desktop, you'd already have the prelims by now."
"But I like your desk," Songjay pointed out.
"Of course you do."
Malcolm tried to bite his tongue, but then added under his breath,
"Asshole."
"Cho,"
Songjay countered without missing a beat. With a sour look over his shoulder, Malcolm clattered off the bottom step and pushed through the door to the parking garage.
"I know what that means now."
"Of course you do."
And for all his dispassionate detachment, there was no missing the maddening, entirely frustrating note of amusement coloring Songjay's voice.
"Because I told you."
Malcolm said nothing, only stalking toward his car. If this kept up, there'd be another homicide on his desk within 24 hours or less, and he wouldn't regret a single damned thing.
2. Say that you love me.
While Malcolm drove them to the crime scene, Songjay leaned against the window and read the notes from the police dispatch. A 911 call had come in approximately an hour ago from a downtown hotel. One that was, according to Malcolm, owned by one of the richest families in Baltimore. A housekeeper had unlocked a suite to clean it and found a body face down in the bed. Male. Not young, but not yet middle-aged. Fit. No identity. But then they'd been warned not to touch the body, not even to get an ID. "There's blood everywhere," the housekeeper had sobbed, per dispatch's notes. "So much blood." He grimaced. Honestly, was it entirely necessary for criminals to be so messy? The disorganized killers always made such a splatter everywhere, hasty and quick to depersonalize the body, to separate themselves from the reality of their crime and any attachment to the victim as a person. Organized killers could be neater when they chose, but the ones who were neat enough not to make a mess were also neat enough not to leave an evidence trail linking their kills, unless they were narcissistic enough to want the attention and enjoy the game of flirting with the police, which left the organized killers who deliberately made messes of the body as a fetishistic ritual. He supposed he would find out which one they were dealing with once they reached the crime scene. At his side, Malcolm was tense, more tense than usual, his slate-blue eyes fixed tightly on the road, sharp gaze occasionally cut by a few tendrils of silver and chestnut hair drifting loose from its tie. Songjae pondered asking why, but the old wolf would only bare his teeth and raise his hackles. Not particularly productive, and Songjae needed his mind on the case and not thinking back to why Malcolm might be so very irritable with him. It was simply because he didn't want a partner, of course. No more than Songjae did. Though they made do while stuck with each other. No other reason. No other reason would be logical. Even if the tension between them, that hot buzzing feeling that made Songjae's blood feel alive, threatened to overwhelm him, filling his head with a slow and pounding throb. He hated it, hated that it never wholly left him, never fully left him at peace. It was just easier to ignore when things were not so tense between them. The address from the dispatch notes turned out to be a high-rise building, paneled in glossy, reflective black lined in gold. Tinted windows, throwing back the sun to create a towering onyx obelisk that spoke of ostentatious wealth, class, and pretension, with the name blazoned down the side of the building in story-high gold letters. Wellington. Just that. As if the name alone was recognizable enough that anyone hearing it should know their brand, their products, their market. Songjae had no idea who they were. People in luxuriant clothing strode down the gold-lined front walk of white marble, not even sparing a glance for the invisible valets who brought their cars around and handed them over. Malcolm parked the Camaro a block back from the front drive of the hotel. At Songjae's inquisitive look, he grumbled,
"I'm not giving them my keys."
"You are possessive of your car?"
"Something like that."
Malcolm tossed his head, shoulders rolling tensely beneath the crisply pressed shoulders of his suit.
"Come on."
Songjae held back a sigh. Malcolm was even more impatient than usual today, and Songjae only hoped it would not impact his ability to focus on the case. Together they strode up the walk to the hotel. A few people flung curious, disdainful glances their way. Songjae supposed even Malcolm's rather nicely tailored suits were considered inferior here, and his own jeans were not the particular sort of couture scruff that wealthy starlets indulged in. People were so bizarre about such things, such affectations. He did not quite understand the point, and it was hardly a surprise when they reached the glass-fronted, gold-framed front door, only to be cut off by a man in a crisp red waistcoat before Malcolm could even reach for the handle. The small, trim man's hair was slicked back and pomaded into a shell. His thin, pinched mustache waxed down until it was barely a dash on his upper lip, like two calligraphic ink strokes. He eyed them, his pinched nose wrinkling.
"Good morning, gentlemen. Are you visiting guests of the hotel?"
Songjae cocked his head.
"Are you not aware that a murder occurred on your premises?"
The man hissed, leaning toward them, eyes narrowing.
"If you could please not publicize this. We're trying to maintain calm, and the Wellington has a reputation."
Songjae exchanged a glance with Malcolm, before Malcolm arched one bushy, skeptical gray brow and flipped out his badge.
"BPD. The faster you let us in, the faster we get this sorted so you can go back to business as usual."
The man stared at them icily, eyeing Malcolm's badge as if searching for signs of forgery, then staring at Songjae as if waiting for him to produce his badge as well. Songjae remained silent. The man held his gaze in a blatant attempt to stare him down, then wrinkled his upper lip and looked back to Malcolm, clearly hesitating. Malcolm sighed.
"We can't investigate a crime from outside the building," he said with weary patience. and you can't exactly toss the body down the laundry chute."
The man's eyes widened with such utter offense that if Songjae were so inclined, he might almost crack a smile. Then the man lifted his chin, tossing his head. Not that it did anything for the little waxed curl of hair laying against his brow, and pushed the door open wider before stepping back.
"This way."
They ducked through before the door could close. He led them through a massive lobby, with arched ceilings so high they faded into shadow, lit only by golden lights dotted among the darkness, like lanterns hanging against a still and quiet night. Even though the lobby was filled with people, from guests to concierges, it was as quiet as an opera hall before a show. Something about the grandeur of the reflective golden ivory flooring and tall, stately columns lining the walls seemed to demand silence of even the most boisterous guests. The loudest sound in the entire room was the steps of their escort, clicking swift and sharp and accusatory, as if he needed to announce exactly how offended he was with every busy stride. He led them past the shining polished wood doors of the main elevators and ducked through a side door hidden behind a tall potted ficus, gesturing to them impatiently. Songjae met Malcolm's wry glance, then followed the man into a narrow hallway of dingy gray-white walls and old ratty gray carpeting, the fluorescent lights cold and flickering dimly, stark contrast to the opulence, elegance, and grandeur of the main lobby. Just to one side was a set of double steel doors, and the man pressed the up button next to the doors impatiently. Malcolm stopped just behind him, his thick bulk looming over the other man.
"You're taking us through the service elevators?" he growled.
The man turned on Malcolm, glaring up at him. It was like a mouse staring down a wolf, and in some bizarre way the mouse was winning.
"I," the man said firmly, "have a duty to my guests, and do not want to cause a panic if any of them should see you and realize something is amiss."
He drew himself up, as if he could puff up enough to outdo Malcolm's bulk.
"When your people arrive to take photographs and dispose of the body, I would appreciate it if they did not attempt to enter through the front door. There is a side entrance for staff."
Malcolm stared at him with the most incredulous expression on his face. Songjae found it quite fascinating. For all his rough edges, Malcolm often gave off a subtle air of one who appreciated finer things, from the well-tailored cut of his suits to his taste in Greek restaurants. Yet he countered it with disgusting, filthy pub dives like Swabby's, and an apparent complete and utter disdain for purveyors of finer lifestyles such as this man. His preferences were as much at opposite extremes as the deadly, rough-edged aura he gave off, paired with the gentleness and patience he so often showed to witnesses. They had barely been working together for a week, but Songjae only found Malcolm increasingly more contradictory, puzzling, and intriguing. The elevator doors swung open. Malcolm stepped forward, forcing the man backward one step at a time, until they stood in the elevator with the narrow little man's back against the wall. Songjae slipped inside just before the doors closed.
"Those people,"
Malcolm growled, a dangerous undertone in his voice,
"are the forensics team and county medical examiner, and they'll come through whatever entrance will fit their equipment."
Penetrating slate blue eyes narrowed.
"You got something to hide, Mr.
Brixton?"
He drew himself up with pride, officious and haughty, and leaned around Malcolm to jab one of the numbers on the elevator plate. The elevator hitched upward, a jolt of high-speed lift making Songjae's stomach drop out.
"I am Caldwell Brixton, the general manager of the Wellington."
"Good for you,"
Malcolm bit off, as the elevator doors swung open on one of the upper floors, revealing glossy marble and wood paneling, and lights subtly spaced among rich velvet hangings.
"Now show me the body."
Some days, Malcolm thought people actually forgot he was actually here to...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?